must have been a moment at the beginning where we could have said no. Somehow we missed it. Well, we'll know better next time.
My brother and my sister, don't speak to me. But I don't blame them. My brother and my sister, don't speak to me. But I don't blame them. My brother and my sister, don't speak to me. But I don't blame them. My brother and my sister, don't speak to me.
I don't blame. I'm sorry for what I've done. I realize that it is premature and also at a very late stage in the game for me to be coming forth. But to come forth is an action which should take place. I apologize for being taller than the person sitting behind me. I apologize for being smaller than the person sitting in front of me. I relinquish nothing and everything in order to stand here before you, and this I apologize for. I do not believe that this will allow me to enter into any new situation without the remembrance of what I've done. I only wish for you to hear me. I apologize for this also. I'm sorry. I've brought shame on my family. I've caused anguish, hurt, pain, and suffering in other families. I've done things which should not have been done. Without naming names, I have provoked, qualified, justified, revoked, endured, summoned, questioned, realized, created, allowed, returned, configured, situated, and muted things I should not have. I will allow for a return of the things that I have taken. They are not mine. They have never belonged to me, and if they could all be restored with no knowledge of me ever possessing or adjusting them, I could regain footing and a holding in this world that I do not or should not belong to. If I am misunderstood, you have only me to blame. I do not warrant this voice. I give this back. I do not hold this ground. It is not mine to stand on. Your hearing is the only thing I have left, and I apologize for this. It is not mine to possess.
I knew these people, these two people. They were in love with each other. The girl was very young, about 17 or 18, I guess. And the guy was quite a bit older. And he was kind of raggedy and wild. And she was very beautiful, you know? And together they turned everything into a kind of an adventure. And she liked that. Just an ordinary trip down to the grocery store was full of adventure. And they were always laughing at stupid things. He liked to make her laugh. And they didn't much care for anything else, because all they wanted to do was be with each other. They were always together. And he loved her more than he ever felt possible. He couldn't stand being away from her during the day when he went to work. So he'd quit just to be home with her. And then he'd get another job when the money ran out. And then he'd quit again. But pretty soon she started to worry.
About what?
Money, I guess. Not having enough.
Hmm?
Not knowing when the next check was coming in.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
So he started to get kind of torn inside.
How do you mean?
Well, he knew he had to work to support her, but he couldn't stand being away from her either.
I see.
And the more he was away from her, the crazier he got. Except now, he got really crazy. He started imagining all kinds of things.
Like what?
He started thinking that she was seeing other men on the sly. He'd come home from work and accuse her of spending the day with somebody else. He'd yell at him and break things in the trailer.
The trailer.
Yes. They lived in a trailer home. Anyway, he started to drink real bad. And he'd stay out late to test her, to see if she'd get jealous. He wanted her to get jealous, but she didn't. She just worried about him. But that got him even madder. He thought if she never got jealous of him, that she didn't really care about him. Jealousy was a sign of her love for him. And then one night, she told him that she was pregnant. She was about 3 or 4 months pregnant, and he didn't even know. And then suddenly everything changed. He stopped drinking, got a steady job. He was convinced that she loved him now because she was carrying his child. And he was going to dedicate himself to making a home for her. But a funny thing started to happen. He didn't even notice it at first. She started to change. From the day the baby was born, she began to get irritated with everything around her. She got mad at everything. Even the baby seemed to be an injustice to her. He kept trying to make everything all right for her, buy her things, take her out to dinner once a week. But nothing seemed to satisfy her. For 2 years, he struggled to pull them back together like they were when they first met. But finally, he knew that it was never going to work out. So he hit the bottle again, but this time it got mean. This time when he came home late at night, she wasn't worried about him or jealous. She was just enraged. She accused him of holding her captive by making her have a baby. She told him that she dreamed about escaping. That was all she dreamed about, escape. She saw herself at night running naked down a highway, running across fields, running down riverbeds, always running. And always, just when she was about to get away, he'd be there. He would stop her somehow. He would just appear and stop her. And when she told him these dreams, he believed them. He knew she had to be stopped or she'd leave him forever. So he tied a cowbell to her ankle so he could hear at night if she tried to get out of bed. But she learned how to muffle the bell by stuffing a sock into it and inching her way out of the bed and into the night. He caught her one night when the sock fell out and he heard her trying to run to the highway. He caught her and dragged her back to the trailer and tied her to the stove with his belt. He just left her there, went back to bed, and lay there listening to her scream. Then he listened to his son's scream. And he was surprised at himself because he didn't feel anything anymore. All he wanted to do was sleep. And for the first time, he wished he were far away, lost in a deep, vast country where nobody knew him, somewhere without language or streets. And he dreamed about this place without knowing its name. And when he woke up, he was on fire. There were blue flames burning the sheets of his bed. He ran through the flames toward the only two people he loved. But they were gone. His arms were burning, and he threw himself outside and rolled on the wet ground.
Then he ran. He never looked back at the fire. He just ran. He ran until the sun came up, and he couldn't run any further. And when the sun went down, he ran again. For 5 days he ran like this, until every sign of man had disappeared.
'cause it makes me feel like I'm falling asleep. I might buckle and fall onto the ground. It feels like they're gonna fall down.
I don't know why, I don't know why, I know anymore. But you are forgiven. You are forgiven.
Sing for you. in the Garden of Eden with Eve. She's naked, ravishingly beautiful. And we are uninhibited and guiltless and free. And she looks so lovely. And she is there for me. I look down at my chest and I see the scar where God removed the rib from which she was created. It's healed nicely. And we make love in the grass outdoors amidst the flowers, fruit-bearing trees, beneath a perfectly blue sky, next to a pool of blue, limpid water. And then we look up in a tree, and we see the serpent, and he says, "If you thought that was good, why don't you try knowing something?" And we say, "What's that?" "You mean, eat of the tree of knowledge? You know God forbade us to do that. That's the one thing we're not supposed to do." And then we turn away from the serpent and we go off and bathe in a stream and we languidly reach for luscious fruit, enjoying the summer afternoon, the sheer sensuality of warm sunlight on our skin, the cool breeze on our brows. And then, one day, I look over a chasm, over some distance, and see Eve reaching for the apple that the serpent suggested. I call out and run to her as fast as I can, and I say, "Look, God said this is the one thing we must not do. We have everything else. For God's sake, Eve, we've got it all. We have a luxurious place to live. The sun shines constantly. When it rains, it's a benign, soft rain just to keep the plants happy. Look at the beautiful physical condition we're in. The years pass. We never seem to grow old. It's a small price to pay to remain ignorant. And what does knowledge lead to anyway, probably, but just a lot of problems and confusion and a desire for more knowledge and a disquieting mental sensation and conflicting emotions and dissatisfaction with the condition of one's life. I mean, I'm not really sure about this, Eve, since I am ignorant, but I have a feeling that this would happen. My emotions tell me this." And Eve says, "Is this all you want? You just want to be like a Philistine and eat and drink and be utterly shallow? Don't you have any intellectual curiosity? And let me tell you something. I really don't respect the abject submission with which you deal with God. It's so low the way you talk with him. You're his dog, his lackey. Sometimes I really lose respect for you, Adam. And this tree of knowledge, it is the most beautiful tree in the garden. And I feel a sense of emptiness that I want to fill. I feel a longing. I want to know things. I want to learn. I want to be somebody. I don't want to just be a nature girl, you know, living in a beautiful garden for eternity. I feel incomplete. I feel there must be more to life than this. I mean, for how many years, for how many centuries are we just going to hang around this garden, eat the fruit and make love and take long walks and dangle our feet in the pool and watch the sunset and listen to the birds sing? I mean, it's getting old, Adam. Is this really all there is? Isn't there something that would leaven this, something that would bring a little spice to it, deepen it, enrich it? I feel so shallow, Adam. I feel as if I suffered just a little bit, I would have some wisdom, whatever that is. And you know, Adam, the serpent, he's so clever. He's so bright and funny. He's educated. That's because he's hung out in the tree of knowledge. He knows all the apples and what's in them. And frankly, Adam, you're a lot of fun. But the serpent is a hell of a lot smarter than you are. So, I just don't want to live like this for eternity. I need more. And frankly, Adam, I just resent, I really resent that God made you first and then he made me out of one of your ribs. I've always held that against him. And I think, you know, in a way it's diminishing of me. And now this tree of knowledge business. Frankly, it pisses me off. I mean, why did he have to do that? He let us have everything, and then this one thing he says we can't do. You know what that is? It's just a power trip that he's on. He's just a control freak. He gives you everything, but then maybe the most important and the best and the most richly satisfying thing, that's the one thing he doesn't let us have. And then she takes a bite of the apple, and another bite. And I say to her, "What, are you insane? Do you have any idea the kind of trouble you're going to get us into?" And she says, "Eat of it. It is the most delicious fruit. I'm a different person. I feel this knowledge that I'm gaining. I see the world differently, and I see it from a perspective that I've never seen it before. And you, Adam, are a child. You are naive. And if you want to be with me, if you think we have any future together, you're going to have to eat of the tree of knowledge also. Because otherwise, we no longer really have anything in common. And so, I eat of the tree of knowledge. And again, we make love. But now, our lovemaking is more lascivious and violent and somehow dirty. She's wearing lace stockings and pumps, and I've got some liquor that I've made out of fermented potatoes. And we make love in the grass, and it's very passionate and frantic. But at the same time, I feel distanced from her. The intimacy and the closeness that we once had, it's long gone. Now it's as though I'm making love to a stranger. It isn't Eve anymore. It's Yvette. And when it's over, there's a sense of disgust and self-loathing, and for the first time I begin to feel that I have to take a shower to clean up afterwards. And we both wash vigorously, and now we're trying to find things to wear to cover our nakedness. And we find different leaves and bushes. And I used to squat against a tree right in front of her and unselfconsciously do my business while talking to her. Or we'd be laughing childishly, and I'd spontaneously urinate, but now I find the necessity to excuse myself and find a private place to relieve myself. I have to walk 100 yards away to a dark place and turn around to make sure she can't see me when I do. And then God shows up, and he says, "What have you done? You have eaten of the tree of knowledge. The one thing I asked you not to do is the very thing you did. I offered you full access, complete reign. For eternity, you would have everything you wanted. And you were so willful, so completely self-centered and disobedient." And Eve says, "The serpent made me do it. He enticed me." And I say, "Eve made me do it." And Eve tosses me an angry glance, and I know she's thinking, "You betrayed me. How could you say this to God?" And then she says, "You weakling, you know perfectly well you were a willing participant with me. And what kind of a man are you that you are going to point the finger at me? What a coward." And then the two of us are cast out of the Garden of Eden. And now it's cold, and I've got to work constantly, regardless of whether I feel like doing it or not. And I develop a taste for meat, and I go out and slaughter animals. And there's no medicine, and the elements are unforgiving, and there's the constant danger that lightning will strike and burn down the place where we live, that flood will overwhelm us, that drought will parch our fields, that locusts or infestation of rodents will denude our cultivation, that our skin will become infested with lice and boils. And I'm really angry at Eve. "You got us into this mess," I tell her. "You should never have listened to the serpent. I should never have listened to you." And Eve is saying, "Let me tell you something, Adam. I don't care. It's better here than it was there. At least I know something."
grass cleared right out. It was harder than hell, so I lay me by the spring forest bed. Let me get as a drought.
Myself. Because I think if I were God and could have anything and do anything, I would turn to my court vizier in heaven and say, "Oh, this is rather a bore. We've seen it for eons. We know what will happen. We are in complete control. Give me a surprise." And suddenly I find myself sitting here. I'd say I didn't bargain for that. Well, Vizzy would say you wanted a surprise, didn't you? See, you're all in that situation. At least that's what it's the only sense I can make out of it. And everything that's going on. That we're doing it. And we do it by this Gigi Mookie principle, whereby everybody's doing it. So that my deeds are your deeds, and your deeds are my deeds. And I must accept responsibility for what you do, just as you must accept responsibility for what I do. It's fair enough, isn't it? Because after all, if we go around and say, "No, that's the responsible fellow, ban him, or praise him," then come the questions if we begin to think about it. Well, is he really responsible? Now, this is the whole problem of evil. The theologians never succeeded in figuring out how Satan, Lucifer, with all his advantages, with the direct beatific vision of God in front of his eyes, could have had the incredible folly to start the mass. So they said it wasn't folly, it was sheer malice. Well, where did he get it from? If he thought up an entirely new principle in the universe called malice, that's really something that only God could do. Yeah, because then, you see, it puts God in a pretty silly position, because then God can turn to the devil and say, "You did it." I don't think I want to worship that kind of God. Because it's a sort of irresponsible. So this business of finding out the person who's guilty and punishing that one, we find always circumstances alter cases. Why was he in that position? And the psychiatrists have something to say. The sociologists have something to say. The lawyers have something to say. And before we know where we are, we're in a tangle. Because when you pick up anything in this universe, all the rest comes with it. Now, it's like picking up a piece of cloth. Pick it up and then all the rest of the cloth comes too. So, when we blame ourselves and praise ourselves, you can't really do one without the other. And both of them are pretty silly. The person who praises himself doesn't realize that the real things for which he should be praised, he doesn't even know how he did. Every genius has no idea how he does such things. If he did, he could teach it. But no genius can simply teach other geniuses to be geniuses. Otherwise, we'd have an overplus of geniuses. I mean, imagine if the Juilliard School of Music turned out Bach's by the dozen. And after a while, we would say, "Oh, this is a bore. Try Shostakovich. Try John Cage." And that is, in fact, what happens. So, the genius can't explain. So there's no point praising myself. I don't particularly praise myself for the kind of voice I have, for the way my bones are built, because I feel I didn't do it. It happened. But I did do it. My ego didn't do it. My concept of myself had nothing to do with it at all. I had all this long before I had a concept of myself. So, when we put aside praising and blaming, we put aside the main cause for having a fear of responsibility. Because there is simply nothing for it in the sort of situation in which we are, but to do it yourself. But to do it with skill. In the sense of, let the real you do it. Not the bogus you that screams and panics and praises and blames. So when the great Zen master Joshu was approached by a young monk who said, I've been in this monastery for some time and would like instruction. And Joshu said, have you had breakfast? He said, yes, and go wash your dishes. Now, it sounds a little philistine. It sounds like the people say, oh, forget all this questions about the universe and get on with your job. They're like a pestiferous child asks his father, why? And the child says, suck your lollipop, damn it. It's not quite like that. Because that sudden sense that, well, why not sweep your own sidewalk? Down as something other than a chore. Duty. We're all doing these things out of a sense of duty. And nobody can keep up doing things out of a sense of duty for more than a few days without becoming embittered. But you see, nobody wants to sweep the sidewalk because they've got much more important things to do. Such as, think of something, running the country, making a mess of things. So I firmly believe that we could begin to act as limbs of Kano. If we get rid of the idea that I, of myself, do anything at all, it happens. So it means like something like this. And this again is a difficult idea because it's unfamiliar. You can't do anything creative in the world until you realize that nothing needs to be done. The world as is, New York as is Avalokiteshvara. It seems unbelievable, but each one of these creatures also, I may remind you, has a horrendous aspect which is sometimes depicted, where they have black faces with staring eyes and fanged teeth and necklaces and garlands of skulls. And they're not devils in our sense. They're just a look at the other side of things. They're the way your teeth look. The teeth of a most beautiful girl look that way to a live shrimp. And don't forget that the shrimp thinks it's human. You may look down on shrimps and think that they're a lower form of life. But they don't think they are. They think you are not a higher form of life, but a rather puzzling form of life. But something like a quasar or an earthquake that's sort of unpredictable and weird. But they know, as shrimps, that they are perfectly civilized, intelligent people. Each one of them feels it's in the middle of the universe, feels that that's the way things are. And you may put it down and say it has a primitive nervous system. But when you start studying that primitive nervous system with an electron microscope, it becomes infinitely complicated. But watch out for shrimps. They are people. So are plants. And they have... they're not altogether well adjusted to the teeth even of a saint who's a vegetarian. So life has that aspect, you see. We're trying to get rid of that aspect. Which we'll call the wrathful side, the dark side. You get rid of the light side at the same time. Because they are interdependent, and you wouldn't realize one without the other.